This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The cost of extreme weather has increased dramatically in recent years. Hurricane Katrina was the most expensive weather event of the past 30 years, with a final price tag of more than $150 billion. Harvey is expected to be in that range on that list of the top few storms, and we're still, of course, watching Irma unfold. Are the economic impacts of these extreme weather events changing policy or behavior more broadly, though? Paula DiPerna is an environmental and philanthropic policy advisor who has worked broadly at the intersection of finance and the environment. She's currently a special advisor to CDP, the Carbon Disclosure Project, and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. She joins me now in our Woods Hole studio. Paula, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. The cost of extreme weather has been going up, and there are kind of two halves to that equation. One is the fact that weather is getting more extreme, and the science linking that to greenhouse gas emissions in many cases is quite clear. But then there's also the fact that building practices, where we build and how we build, how we develop potentially vulnerable areas, doesn't necessarily seem to have been getting any more sustainable as the weather is getting more extreme. Is there a disconnect here between what the science is telling us and the financial pressures and how markets and policy is actually responding to this?
You know, there is and there isn't a disconnect because it's partly, you know, the role of science in the culture. If you think about it, you know, if we're all sort of programmed to deny, right, or we would never get up in the morning. So, you know, science is there to inform our daily thought process and our daily practice. And, you know, with regard to the disconnect, it's also a question of timeline. I remember vividly a presentation that was given at the U.S. Congress some time ago by Kathy Sullivan, an astronaut who was the first woman to walk in space. She was recently the head of NOAA in Washington. And a few years ago, or more than a few, she gave an incredible presentation to the staff of one of the major committees on climate in the House of Representatives, and it was a 40-minute talk, and it was called The State of the World's Oceans. And she gave a 40-minute slide presentation with pictures from space and showing how the science of observation from the space shuttle had helped influence the way that farmers in Brazil chose soybeans. They were able to predict drought conditions and therefore purchase certain kinds of soybeans and planted those versus others. Same with sardines, all kinds of important economic effects that were precipitated and informed by science from space. And her last remark was, "I stand behind every single word of what I've just said. You are all policymakers and you need to be very, very sure about your facts. Well, I'm giving you facts on which I would bet my reputation. I stand on these facts. In 40 minutes, I was able to deliver you facts on which I stand because of at least 40 years of science." So there's a built-in timeline or a time lag because of the way science proceeds. It's not supposed to be an instant process. That's where policy comes in. And so science is, interestingly, informing capital flows now much more effectively and much more strongly than meets the eye. So, for example, these discussions about green bonds or even the discussion of divestment that you've discussed here before, all of this trend towards getting out of fossil fuels is informed by the science. Now, where the breakdown comes is in the timing.
I mean, when we think about the flow of money in particular in response to natural disasters, insurance, right? Insurers typically end up taking up about half of the kind of immediate local cost of damages from these extreme weather events. The events themselves are becoming more extreme and it seems more inevitable in a lot of cases, the damage becoming more certain. How does the insurance industry, which is typically very data-driven, how are they incorporating the science and what kind of shifts are happening there?
Well, they're moving rather quickly because they have to. I mean, the reinsurance industry, for example, is seeing its stock prices fall because of they're the insurer of last resort after FEMA or in concert with FEMA. So the insurers are all looking at, reviewing their actuarial conclusion tables to integrate better climate science. One of the interesting things about this, again, going back to the scientific method, is, you know, what are the probabilities of events? And interestingly, you know, the recent extreme hurricanes, people have been saying, well, did they derive from climate change? Didn't they? How can you attribute one event back to a particular trend in science? And of course, the insurance industry has to somehow sort through this confusion and pick out a few factors that are controllable. So in the same way that the insurance industry has figured out how to insure cars, you know, you have a car accident. It could be because your brakes are bad. It could be because you're drunk. Could be because the light didn't work. There are many possible reasons why the accident could have occurred, but still your car's insured. So I figure if they can insure cars when there's so many potentially contradictory factors that cause the accident, they'll be able to figure out how to insure against climate change risk.
And yet, even then, what you're insuring against a car accident is a relatively rare event. I mean, extreme natural disasters are, in the grand scheme of things, I guess, rare, but they're becoming less rare. And for some of these properties, we're seeing the same properties that are in flood-prone or disaster-prone areas being hit time and time again. Are these really eventualities that can and should be insured for?
Well, insurance is only probably one tool, but we probably, in the face of climate change, need to rethink some of these formulas. So that's where policy comes in, because, you know, science plus capital equals policy is the new equation as far as I'm concerned. So when you think about trying to influence policy, you usually think about an interest group plus a lobbying effort equals policy. And what I'm saying is science plus capital will now have to equal policy. So if people keep rebuilding or being allowed to rebuild in known areas that are, you know, very susceptible to climate change risk or flooding, and yet the insurance companies cannot find a formula that they can stand on that they're comfortable with to insure those properties, then policy has to come in and either pick up the slack and insure those properties for a price that we would be willing to pay as people who have to pay for it, or the building cannot be permitted. You know, that's a draconian sort of method, but we might be getting to that where there are bans on seashore construction. And probably we will be seeing more of that, which nobody really wants to be told what to do. But we may, the science again may be telling us.
As we've been seeing in the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey, the economic impacts are not limited just to those communities and those homes or businesses who are directly impacted. And I'm thinking here in particular of the fact that gas prices around the country and right here in Massachusetts have very quickly been rising because oil refineries in Texas were affected by Hurricane Harvey. And we've seen a trend in the past couple of years increasingly towards shareholders really asking, pressuring large businesses to disclose their vulnerabilities to climate change impacts. And this feels like it's just one big, really public, unanticipated climate disclosure, right? That, oh, our refineries, our infrastructure is really vulnerable to this flooding.
Well, I guess one of the things that's good about money is that it's visible, right? You can see things through the lens of money. So increased prices at the gas station, you know, might open the eyes of people who, for example, would have balked completely at a gas tax that might have been diverted for further investment in renewable fuels. So to that extent, there could be some eye-opening or awakening. It's unfortunate that it might come at the expense of, let's say, the poorer people. But to your point about disclosure, you know, this is in a way a globalized television program, what's going on, because to the extent that gas prices go up in Martha's Vineyard or Boston or Woods Hole because of what happened in Houston, it just reinforces what we already talk about all the time, globalization as an economic prospect and the atmosphere as a physical prospect. So back to, you know, disclosure, just as a little point, Carbon Disclosure Project, where I'm involved, started environmental disclosure in 2003. They started asking companies to disclose in 2003, and they had 80 companies respond, and they had 30 signatories at that time. Now there's thousands of companies disclosing, and there's more than 800 investor groups asking for that information. And that disclosure has pressed this green wave of investment and some of the other things that we were talking about earlier with regard to capital.
I wonder, though, with communities who are not facing these immediate threats, not dealing with this aftermath right now, but looking at it and thinking, what do we do to be ready when it might be our turn? Other than insurance, what are the financial tools that might be available to cities and towns, to policymakers who are trying to be more prepared for extreme weather events in the future?
So this is the sort of good news aspect of what's going on. I mean, every age has bad news and has good news. An immediate tool is the green bonds movement, green bonds, where investments are made specifically to ameliorate or mitigate an environmental risk, but at the same time, they improve general infrastructure conditions. So, for example, in Seattle, a major, major, the largest green bond issuance in the country so far for light rail transport. So this has tremendous longer-term implications for the economy of that area because it's public transportation. So you get rid of greenhouse gases, you raise money to develop public transportation, but you also strengthen the physical infrastructure of the city and you employ people. These needs can be addressed at the same time as we address what is generally considered to be a disastrous infrastructure situation. So green bonds are very, very important, growing significantly. There was just a report within the last 2 days from HSBC that suggests that green bonds are now outperforming. They're a very good investment anyway because they're considered to be very stable, very low-risk assets or low-risk investments. But they're outperforming a little bit recently because there's a demand for them in the secondary market, which means that there's a demand and the supply may be getting tighter. Why might it be getting tighter is because the green component is being more stringently looked at to avoid greenwashing or calling anything, you know, just plastering the word green on it. But so infrastructure we need anyway. And if the science is informing us that our natural infrastructure is being threatened and we reinvest in supporting and preserving our natural capital, that can only have tremendous effects in helping us preserve and develop our physical capital and eventually our social and human capital.
That's Paula DiPerna. She's an environmental and philanthropic policy advisor. Paula, thanks so much.
Thank you.